Being Programmed to Chill, a show about business, crime, parapolitics, and esoterica, with your host, Jimmy Fallon Gong.
So, 1919, the worst of the Russian Civil War is kind of over after they defeat Denikin. But almost immediately, the Polish and Soviet war starts in 1920.
It's just one thing after another.
It's literally just one thing after another. And like sort of the basics for the Polish Soviet war was that Poland, which again had sort of just reemerged in the aftermath of World War One, because it wasn't a state for a while, right? Like Poland, not to get into the deep history of Poland, but like Poland has always been partitioned several times, right?
It's not fun to be Poland.
Not fun to be Polish. And I think they hadn't existed as a country since like the late 1700s at this point. So when they reemerged, like when the new Polish state reemerged, they looked at some territory in Ukraine and Lithuania and Belarusia, and like they were like, that's ours. And they just basically invaded. And then again, Trotsky, stepped up and led the Red Army against the Polish. Another player who sort of gets introduced here is a guy named Mikhail Tukhachevsky.
Tukhachevsky, you say?
Tukhachevsky, right? Yeah, remember that name, because it's gonna be play a bigger part in the sort of schemes to come, I guess.
Or as I call it, the only Russian general that any American seems to know, other than maybe Zhukov.
Yeah, I would say a lot more people seem to know Zhukov, but yeah, Tukhachevsky is definitely another one. He was, again, going back to the Napoleon thing, he was called the Red Napoleon during his heyday. So they win a couple victories in Ukraine and in Belarus, and they're marching on Warsaw, and this is a we'll play into a little bit more information later, but I read in my research that one of the things that sort of saved the Polish state at this point was their long-established relationship of intelligence sharing with the Empire of Japan, who tipped them off about Russian movement towards Warsaw and sort of gave them the necessary intelligence edge for the so-called miracle on the Viga or whatever.
For the listener's sake here, as Chad and I were talking and planning this episode, he discovered the incredibly interesting subterranean history of Polish intelligence, which we only touch on here, but like, it seems extremely interesting. And so I'm just like, ooh, gotta brush up on my Polish, I guess.
Same, right? And I definitely want to read like way more about this, but just to sort of give, I guess, like a quick version of it, right? The Polish army intelligence had a longstanding tradition of wanting to destabilize and sort of undermine Russia. And they did so by sort of reaching out to all of the various national identities that Russia had colonized through its time as an empire, basically. And this would later, in the later 20s, develop into something called the Promethean League, which is essentially a network of spies with the sole dedication of uniting every possible force that could be united against Russia and then later the Soviet Union under sort of one mission. It also had a sort of Polish nation building project in which they wanted to see the return of the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth.
Which, like, first of all, it's almost like the first Wackle before Wackle, but... Mm-hmm. Like separate too, it's like gets into such interesting territory that we don't have time for with both Ukraine and Poland, with like what is a nation. Like there were times at which like Poland as such was just a bunch of like French nobles and shit. Like
yeah,
the idea that Poland is a nation it's true now, but like historically it wasn't even true in a certain sense. And like there were always long historical ties between Poland and Ukraine. Like it's such a nebulous, interesting question that like, unfortunately, we got to stay focused on the man, Trotsky.
Yeah. Yeah. Got to stay focused on that. So we'll even like just sort of jump ahead to at like after the Polish-Soviet War ends in 1922. Right. Mm-hmm. And I guess this sort of section starts talking about the formation of Trotsky's left-wing opposition within the CPSU itself, right? So the Russian Social Democratic Labor Party is gone. It is now the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, and Trotsky is, you know, in the party with all the gang, right? And all the stars are there. So one of the first sort of big kind of splits, right? And we already mentioned it a little bit, was Trotsky's opposition to what was called the new economic policy. So this was Lenin's idea, and it was basically just like a proposal for an interim return to a mixed market economy as a means of basically, you know, that old bugbear, building up productive forces. Trotsky opposed this. He wanted to continue on war communism, which his opposition described as tightening the screws of war communism, which was, that is to say, expand it even further than what it already was. Trotsky argued that, you know, this initial coercion of the NEP, this reintroduction of a mixed market socialism, would be derailed in favor of capitalism. And, you know, Lenin shut it down. Like in typical Lenin fashion, with a couple speeches and a pamphlet and a lot of shit talking, you know, and then basically made the claim that like, we've gone this far, like socialism is sort of like a committed sort of like ideological project right now. And that like, everybody will understand that this is a temporary measure to work. So Trotsky gets outvoted, and then naturally, he sort of, you know, came to accept the plan, but then was also simultaneously making claims that he in fact was the original advocate for the plan. So, you know, I guess.
And it's funny too, right? Because it's like, yeah, he'll take credit for the NEP, but then he'll also say that like, my plan was basically rapid industrialization and collectivization of farming. And then also get on Stalin's ass for doing exactly that.
Exactly, right. Because like they describe Stalin's sort of like political journey as like a zigzag. And like more or less Stalin was kind of responding to the material conditions, right? So like the zigzag is sort of makes sense in that approach. But like Trotsky's, his view, you know, it's essentially like whatever Stalin did is wrong and whatever I'm proposing is right, even when those things are like the same thing, you know?
Yeah. And it's like the NEP was probably the right move at the time, right? Like,
I think so too. Yeah.
Cause they stayed in power. That's the metric of success, essentially.
Right. But there were some problems with the NEP, right? One was notably called the scissor crisis, which I'm not an economics guy, but like my basic understanding of that is that the factories were producing too many industrial goods that the agricultural sector could not afford to purchase. So things were just sort of like splitting off into like the scissor shape. And it was
leading, especially if you can't export like at all, which they couldn't.
They could not do. Trotsky, sensing yet another schism to take advantage of, uses this moment to sort of write an open letter to the Politburo, criticizing the lack of inter-party democracy, and blames this as the cause of the problems. And it's interesting because like this is where Trotsky starts to sort of instruct his supporters, right, his bloc, to basically violate party unity, right, and like, going back to democratic centralism, right, the strength of this sort of organizational model that Lenin devised, right, is that like we have our robust period of debate where everybody airs out their opinions and talks about potential problems, but once something is decided on, everybody has to act towards its accomplishment in Unity, right?
Yeah.
And for Trotsky to be instructing his supporters in the ranks of the new Soviet state to, like, it's not like outright sabotage, but he's basically asking for, like, slowdowns, which anybody who's ever read any criticism of unions should know what that is. It's just everybody starts working at a slower pace, production goes down, and it makes the plan essentially, like, look bad. And he was doing this to sort of reopen the issue again, probably because he wanted war communism to come back. I don't really know. But for whatever reason, he wanted the plan to sort of fail and started moving things around to make sure that that happened. Around this, the NEP period is when Lenin has multiple strokes. I think he had like three. So he's pretty fucked up. Yeah. He's no longer able to participate in party life. He's kind of retired to his house. And one of the, Trotsky is always sort of yammering at him and trying to get him to basically name Trotsky as his chosen successor. But it doesn't necessarily happen, other than in the form of a note called Lenin's Testament, in which the note attacks a bunch of old Bolshevik leaders. Like, it goes after Kamenev, it goes after Zinoviev. I think it might have gone after Piekutov too.
Doesn't it go after Trotsky, but in not particularly biting ways, which is like, wink.
Exactly. Yeah. It's almost like he's too good, like that kind of shit. And then it also issues a grave warning about Stalin, which really, if you read it, it just sounds like Lenin is saying that Stalin is rude. Yeah. And that because of that rudeness, he would be too unkind and too brutal with the working class to be a good leader. Stalin also famously did not dispute this. he was like, yeah, I'm fucking rude. he said, I am rude towards those who are rudely and disloyally destroying and disintegrating the party. Stalin had an interesting sort of mentality, and it gets tossed around now, which is kind of, I guess, a good sign. But Stalin did try to resign from his post like several times and was voted down by the party. And at this point, Stalin he's kind of elevated a little bit past, his prior sort of role as just a good Bolshevik, like a grinder, like an earner. Stalin was an earner, right? For sure. But it wasn't until sort of like Lenin sat down with him and helped him write out the theory of the national question that Stalin got sort of like elevated into the party and was considered like a serious thinker. But yeah, Stalin is quoted as saying, I've never abandoned my post, whatever the post it was, and I have no right to abandon it because that would be desertion. And as I have said before, I am not a free man. When the party binds me, I have to submit. A year later, I once handed more of my resignation, but the party again obliged me to remain. What else could I do? So like, that's the attitude that this guy has, right? And meanwhile, Trotsky is basically like jumping on the opportunity as soon as Lenin goes down to sort of like, move up, basically.
Yeah. And like, should we talk about just even briefly, like, do you think that the Lenin letter or the, what's the term? The Lenin's Testament. Do you think it's real?
Yeah, I kind of do think it's real. But I think that the interpretations of it is where it gets like blown out of proportion. Right. Because again, in the actual testimony itself, he really just says that Stalin is just a little bit too crass, right? Mm-hmm. Which very well might have been true.
He was like mean to Lenin's wife or something.
Yeah, yeah. Like, he famously yelled at Lenin's wife because she was like having him like read like party documents and like Pravda and stuff, and Stalin was like, this man had his third stroke, like, it's not doing any good to just like agitate him up like this, and I think he might have called Lenin's wife a bitch or something like that, or whatever the like Russian equivalent is to that. And she just basically never forgave him. And then she got Lenin involved, and you know, he had to put out the statement.
But on the flip side, there is some evidence that it could be fake, but
there is,
it
yeah.
really doesn't even matter, because Lenin, like, this isn't a fucking monarchy. Like, Lenin's, there is no successor to Lenin. It's just the party, right?
Right, right. Right. It has to be decided democratically. And that's exactly what happened. Stalin and I think a couple other people get, I forget their names, probably important, but let me look it up. They get elected to the first Troika, right?
Yeah.
Which is like a group sharing of power by Stalin and was it Zinoviev and Kamenev?
I'll be honest, I don't remember. I know it is important. At different points, he had different Troika, right? I mean,
yeah. And it was Kamenev and Zinoviev
at that juncture. Yeah,
yeah. Okay. And that, the first Troika was Stalin, Kamenev, and Zinoviev, and that lasted from 22 to 25. And this sort under this Troika is where Trotsky's probably second, like not even second, probably his primary big beef with Stalin comes into play. And that was basically through the ideological struggle between the idea of permanent revolution and socialism in one country. Right. So like we mentioned before, Trotsky's theory of permanent revolution, not really his theory, right? It's sort of like an orthodox reading of Marxism, which basically says that class struggle begins at the international level. And that all national conditions are just kind of like, you know, peculiar expressions of this overall struggle, right? Stalin felt the other way. Like he said that it is a responsibility for the, you know, as the first sort of like socialist victory in the world to build up its socialist forces in such a way that it cannot be overtaken again, right? It cannot be undermined by the bourgeois, and will therefore become the sort of like center of the socialist project, right? It's like the first step, I guess.
And like a complicating factor to all this is that all of the Bolsheviks thought that other revolutions would happen.
Yes.
And in fact, they were like banking on it. They were really needing for, especially Germany was like the main one, to like have a revolution. And like, you know, on my show, I've talked about like the fact that that was actually extremely possible.
Mm-hmm.
And there were multiple German revolutions that attempted it, got further than you would think. But, and in fact, the Bolsheviks were like trying to like nudge that along through different acts. But like it didn't work. And then there were no revolutions. And so like Lenin, the other Bolsheviks, they're like, oh fuck, what do we do now?
Yeah. By 1923, like that, mm-hmm. that post-war revolutionary fervor in Europe had just basically come to a standstill.
Smothered to death in its crib.
Yeah, smothered to death in its crib. And not just Germany too, but like I think also like Italy, mm-hmm. as well as Poland, and even some of the Balkan countries like Bulgaria and Romania too. So it was clearly there was not going to be this moment that Trotsky wanted really badly of like the pan, like I said, the pan-European Soviet. Like it just wasn't going to come to be, and so because of that development. Trotsky essentially adopted the permanent revolution argument and was sort of premising it as like this reason for why socialism could not succeed in the Soviet Union, even though they had a successful revolution, right? Mm-hmm. Like they were like Russia, we're too backwards. We're not developed enough industrially to compete with the capitalist world. And like, you know, it was just, it would probably just be best if we just sort of like take a moderate sort of like coexistence with them until, you know, the rest of the world basically catches up, right? Until there's another revolutionary fervor that's, you know, going to overtake Europe. And like Trotsky always viewed that that was like right around the corner. And one of the sort of like key like tenets that he of this like theory of his that he would always harp on, which was the antithesis to what Stalin believed, was that the peasantry in Russia was too backwards to accept socialism. And they just weren't going to get behind it. And again, I mean, this makes sense when you think about all the peasants Trotsky was killing in Ukraine, right?
On the one hand, there's some real truth to that, that like getting the peasants on board was like very hard in that particular context. Also, technically, there is a Orthodox reading of Marx where didn't he call the French peasantry a sack of potatoes or something?
Yeah.
So like there is a reading that could stand up, but like on the flip side, both Stalin and Mao sort of understood that like you could in fact get the peasants on board.
Right. Especially in a situation like Russia and like China, where there were still remnants of feudal society. Right. Mm-hmm. So like there were plenty of beefs that the peasants had with like their landlords. And that could be channeled into a revolutionary fervor. And Stalin even went on to define it in Foundations of Leninism as one of like the key components of Russian revolutionary power. Right.
Right. Like look at the flag. It's the hammer and the sickle.
Exactly. But Trotsky, no, he's like, these people are too stupid. They'll never get it done. Like we got to basically turn the entire country into proletariat. And then we can have like a proper socialist country. And maybe by then, like the rest of the world will be caught up.
Which like when you look at Trotsky's connections to Wall Street,
yeah,
turning the whole country into proletariat kind of makes me think for just a split second about the guy with the millionaire uncle who wants to turn the whole country into proletariats, then maybe one day in the future do another revolution.
Oh yeah. And when we get into you know, the conspiracy, like some of the concessions that Trotsky was promising was like, oh damn, like yeah. He was ready to give up large sections of the Russian economy to you know, basically imperialist interest.
You hate to see it.
Yeah, really truly hate to see it. Trotsky also had a sort of negative view of the revolutionary potential of the oppressed nationalities in the colonies. And this included analysis of countries other than Russia, like the quote unquote, like black nation within the United States. Like he denied these liberation movements as something unique of themselves and just sort of called them transitional demands of class struggle, which obviously wasn't too popular to some of the like, you know, decolonial thinkers of the time, right? And
wait, are you saying that Trotsky was a class reductionist?
yeah, he was. Yeah, Trotsky was a pretty big class reductionist, and
amazing.
If we talk about like some, he inserted himself in the Chinese Revolution a lot. And that was, again, one of his big sort of like views was just like, do not fuck with the peasantry. Like, basically, like, we got to build up communes among proletariats in the few industrialized centers within China.
And it worked so well, didn't it?
Yeah, it worked great, right? yeah, it was like, it's such a condescending sort of like foundation for this theory, right? Like, It's incredible how it's not like more rejected like outright. But in truth, I also think that a lot of like Trotsky's adherents don't really view it that way and just sort of like stick with the sort of like idealistic, like rose colored glasses interpretation, which is just like
the just so stories.
Yeah. They just want the big internationalist vibes, right? They don't want to know like why exactly Trotsky was so against a sort of like socialism in one country approach. Mm-hmm. So yeah, he would harp on this until the day he died, right? Like this was always going to be his position. This was his number one bugbear. Like everything that the USSR under Stalin was doing in terms of like industrialization and collectivization to, you know, rapidly increase Russia's economic output, industrial output ahead of the Second World War. All of it was wrong because it was just going to fail, right? Because like unless there was an international proletarian struggle going on, socialism in any one place was doomed. So it's it's defeatist by definition, right? Like you can't really excuse it. So I don't know. Yeah.
It's very, very interesting because it's like, because of like the positions he was forced into, it warps the whole ideology into a very weird anti-communism that completely informs what comes later, right?
Yeah, it's kind of like moving the goalposts, you know. Mm-hmm. And it just creates this sort of like conditional placeholder that needs to be achieved before actual communism can be possible. And yeah, you're right, like that it is like sowing the seeds for left anti-communism, like right there, you know, because whatever emerges, right, precluding a international proletarian revolution is doomed to fail, and like therefore like fake socialism by definition, right?
Exactly.
So yeah, dumb approach.
No, I just had a small section on Russian gold reserves.
Okay.
All right. So, you know me. I got to bring it back to accounting again, right?
Love it.
So, the story of Russia's gold reserves is a wild ride, okay? So, in 1914, the Russian Empire had 807 million in gold reserves. Mind you, that's in that year's currency. So adjusted, that would be, you know, billions. Now, Russia had among the largest gold reserves in the world at the time. So some people might know that, like, because of World War One and World War Two, a lot of the gold, the United States ended up with like a huge amount of the gold by the end of both World Wars, right? Mm-hmm. But it's not like the story of how that happens tells a lot, and especially with the Bolsheviks or, you know, the Soviet Union. So 1914, they had 807 million in gold reserves. During World War One, the Russian government sent 400 million abroad, like literally sent the gold mostly to Great Britain to underwrite war purchases. So about half of it is out of the country. A lot of countries were doing this due to, like, it's like financing of the war, you know, it tends to like break almost every country, especially if the war is not a temporary thing. So by the time of the October Revolution, the Bolsheviks ended up in control of around 308 million in gold, which was split in two chunks, basically. So there was there was 308 million in gold in Moscow and 332 million stored in another city, right? So like half and half. So like something like 640 million total. By 1918, the White Russians, specifically Admiral Kolchak, captured half of the total gold that Russia had, 332 million. Not the chunk in Moscow, but the other portion that was more in the central part of the country. And it's estimated that he's managed to spend 122 million just wasting it, basically, and or buying weapons. And so 48 million of Kolchak's gold ended up in US or British banks. Like, we know for sure that's where that went. In 1919, the Whites exported 210 million on a train to Vladivostok. This train actually got derailed. And so 32 million was just completely lost. Like, probably some very rich people, like in Siberia or something. The Reds were able to recover 178 million of that gold and sent it back to Moscow. Meanwhile, the Reds also, you know, the Soviet Union, had to give 160 million to the Germans because of the treaty conditions of Brest-Litovsk. Like, they just had to just straight pay tons of gold to Germany.
Yeah.
Just to settle that, right?
Yeah, keep it from invading, basically.
Pretty much. So that pretty much left the Bolsheviks with something like a cool 300 million in gold bullion by 1920. By 1921, it was down to 175 million. And then by August of 1921, it was down to 1,264,000. And then soon it was down to zero. What happened to the gold? Like, this is one of the great, like, mysteries of history. Like,
yeah,
where did the Russian gold go?
I would watch this movie.
Right? Yeah. Like, talk about, like, you know, a lot of actors that could be scooping up the gold. But we do know most of what probably happened. There is a lot of room for, like, different shipments of gold going missing or whatever. But, like, basically, Russia's gold was bought up by Wall Street. Mm-hmm. And you can actually trace a lot of it through specific shipments of gold bullion making its way through Sweden, where they actually melting it down and then re-stamping it. And then they sent it to London, Paris, but especially New York City. We know that in 1921, a New York steamship brought 46 million in gold to New York City. Like, the main receivers of this gold were, surprise, surprise, J.P. Morgan and Kuhn Loeb and Company.
Huh.
So Kuhn Loeb and Company imported total something like 102 million in Russian gold, close to a quarter of the Russian gold reserves, like total, like end result. So these facts alone without any context could probably be misinterpreted. This gold was sold, not stolen, right? Separate from the white armies taking the gold or whatever. But like these were moves that the Soviet Union made. But nevertheless, there's a lot of ambiguity as to why, right? Because for one thing, they sold the gold to open up trade, and American products began to be imported to the Soviet Union shortly thereafter. So like, it was like opening up like markets for one thing. So in a certain sense, it's probably a smart money move. I think they also invested a fair amount of gold into Scandinavia. But I will read from Professor Spence here. Another possibility is that the gold in part was payment on a debt, or put another way, a return on past American investment in the Russian Revolution.
No shit.
Was that why Kuhn Loeb garnered the lion's share? Another idea is that the Bolsheviks transferred wealth abroad as a rainy day fund to support them in exile and finance a new revolutionary movement should the Soviet regime collapse. During late 1920 and early 1921, the Bolsheviks confronted both economic ruin and the rising tide of peasant rebellion. One admittedly iffy source maintains that by 1921, there was the equivalent of 90 million sequestered in U.S. and Swiss banks under accounts controlled by Lenin, Trotsky, Furstenberg, Cheka chief Felix Dzerzhinsky, and others. Trotsky, for instance, supposedly had 11 million in a New York bank, and Furstenberg, 10 million. Any way you look at it, was Wall Street just reaping what it sowed? My words here.
Yeah.
Granted, we don't know that there were Swiss banks that Lenin had, right, with like tons and tons, like millions. Mm-hmm. But could I see someone like Dzerzhinsky and Trotsky doing that? Yes, absolutely. Right. Mm-hmm. And then there's a certain amount of deniability, because it's like, is that a fund for future revolutions, or is that a fund for your activities should this revolution not work out? Either way, like what we know for certain is that Russia's gold ended up in Wall Street. And as to why, I don't know. You could interpret those facts in a bunch of ways, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if anyone was going to have use for a rainy day fund to start a new revolutionary movement, it would be Leon Trotsky after 1929.
The guy who literally did it. Yep.
Yeah. And he literally tried to do it, you know, and I guess, you know, in some respects did it. Huh. Interesting.
And like, to be fair, a lot of countries' gold ended up in Wall Street. And, you know, like, this is not like Russia kind of like got extra screwed because of all of the sanctions and everything. Mm-hmm. But like, so like, this should be compared to other countries that also had to empty out their gold reserves. But like, they did it more so, and it went right to the people that like Trotsky met with. Like, yeah.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, because like Trotsky has connections with all of these people that were getting paid back, essentially, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Huh.
Interesting, right?
Very, yeah. Huh. Yeah, that's pretty good. So we're back still in like the early 20s, right? And Trotsky is basically pissing everybody off. Like, he won't let go of like permanent revolution as like the, you know, it has to be the platform that's adopted. At this point, like, people are starting to call his block and his supporters like the permanentists. So like, you know, just to give you an idea of how much they were like were bringing this issue up again and again and again. Trotsky was also going around at this point, like locating other oppositional groups, including two secret groups that were called Workers' Truth and Workers' Group, which had like a different, you know, sort of like interpretation of how factory life should be, you know, undergone. Like, they wanted to see a return to like more sort of like direct democracy on the factory level, and less of a sort of like centralized control to the economy that the NEP had sort of created, right? And Trotsky and all these guys like put together some like open letters, I guess, criticizing the party. Famously, one was called the Declaration of the 46, that was in, I think, October 1923 or 24. But basically, they were all sort of like boiling down to this demand for increased inter-party democracy, which essentially meant that they wanted the, like Trotsky especially, wanted an exclusive right to keep bringing up issues that had already been decided, right? Like that was really the main purpose, because there was a democratic process like to these sort of decisions. Like the approach for socialism in one country was voted in by the majority, you know? It was the adopted decision of the CPSU at the time. And for Trotsky to sort of like keep bringing it up again and again and again, like it's not a direct sort of like violation of party unity, but it is undermining it. You know what I mean?
Wait. Are you trying to tell me that Trotsky is wrecking?
Yeah, he's starting to wreck. The man is starting to wreck. And it sort of like comes to a crescendo in late 1924 when Trotsky publishes a book called Lessons of October, which is basically his version of what happened in 1917, and he puts Zinoviev and Kamenev on like full blast for not supporting the move to take power, which was a previously like not publicly known thing, but Trotsky.
That's really funny.
I know, right? Like
publishing the group DMs talking shit about someone type of thing.
Yeah, that's exactly what it was. And so like literally everybody is fucking pissed at him. Like, no, like they've all had enough of this bullshit. This is where the letter that Trotsky wrote denouncing Lenin after they let his Pravda go under and then started a new Pravda in St. Petersburg. Like, this is when he gets brought back up.
Oh man. So they start leaking his DMs. Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah, exactly. So, his constant disagreements with Lenin and the Bolsheviks prior to 1917 have sort of brought up. They sort of saying like, you know, hey man, your version of events is not like really how it happened. And then they also start getting on him for all the shit that he was doing as the head of the Red Army during the Civil War, right?
Mm-hmm.
His harsh treatment of the subordinates, his sort of like his you know war communism antics, the Kronstadt thing, all of it is getting aired out. And at this point, like people are ready to just completely like wipe their hands clean of this guy. Like Zinoviev was demanding that Trotsky would be expelled from the Communist Party in I think 1925, right?
That's so funny.
But guess who came to his aid, man? Guess who said no?
Who?
Stalin.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, Stalin was like, nah, like I know this guy fucking sucks, but like you know, he is a pretty good organizer. Like maybe if he can come back to, you know, fall in line, you know, we can make use out of him.
I'm sure that just drove Trotsky even more insane.
I'm sure it did. Yeah, I'm sure there was something about this like Georgian brute like having to be his like his savior that really got under his skin. So this leads to a period Trotsky's life, which is called a year in the wilderness, right? So like he's basically done with all of his top positions. He'd either been removed from them or he resigned. He's no longer head of the Red Army. He's no longer the People's Commissar for Foreign Affairs. I think they like sort of like were trying to give him some like make work positions that he like didn't want, you know, like famously refused to do, and was just basically sick for like a year and kind of like, I guess, licking his wounds like in a cabin somewhere, you know, not really trying to like stick his head out.
He's tired of all these fake friends.
Yeah. He's tired of all these fake friends. So he's just hanging out with his wife, his second wife at the time. And just lamenting, I guess, probably writing. Cause shortly after that is when he puts out, his biography, My Life. So he's taking the time to sort of like build up that brand, you know what I mean? Like crafting that Trotsky story of how he's like the, you know, the unappreciated Bolshevik leader, you know, you guys will be sorry if I'm gone, like that kind of stuff. Like it's really given those kind of vibes. So he eventually does stick with one position, which is the chairman of the concessions committee. But he resigned as the head of, he wouldn't take the head of the electrical technical board and the scientific technical board of industry. Like they were trying to give him basically like, I guess like bureaucratic jobs. And he just didn't think the title was prominent enough for a man of his stature. So 25 is also the year that the first troika breaks up, right?
Friendship ended with Kamenev and Zinoviev.
Yeah. Friendship ended with Zinoviev and Kamenev. Stalin then gets into an alliance with Bukharin and Rykov, which I guess these guys were sort of like the NEP guys, right?
You ever, when in your time on the left, do you ever hear guys who are just like, yeah, I'm really into Bukharin, actually, like hipster Bukharinites?
Yeah. I have, actually. Yeah, they're an interesting like substrata of Marxist guys, I guess. Yeah. Not nearly as obscure or as interesting and confusing as the people who identify as like Kautskyites, but
yeah,
the Bukharinites actually exist. I personally also am like, I think Bukharin was probably pretty smart.
He was a cool guy up to a point. Yeah, to a point.
He also was one of the big dudes that helped develop the socialism in one country theory with Stalin. So, you know, he was on the right side of some of these issues. But like a shark smelling blood in the water, as soon as Trotsky realized that the troika was gone, he emerges again, right? So this time he unites with Zinoviev and Kamenev, the guys that he put on blast in his book, as well as a dude named Vladimir Smirnov, who I believe was part of those one of those groups like that had a problem with the NEP, the Workers' Choice or Workers.
Okay.
Smirnov was already, at this point, even like of the mind that the USSR was like a degenerated like worker state.
Interesting.
Yeah, he wasn't happy with the situation. He was affected. I think he was effectively part of a group called the Group of 15 at this point. But he left that group and sort of like united with Trotsky on this stuff.
It is interesting to see almost like Trotsky absorbing like ideas of other people and then becoming the guy known as like permanent revolution, the guy known as degenerate worker state. And it's like, it's just interesting.
Yeah, man. He's throughout his career, he's always like lifting other people's bars and like saying that they're his own, you know? So he sort of like becomes a galvanizing agent in rallying the various like left communists and sort of like rightist oppositions into one big sort of thing just called the United Opposition, right? And this is like the group that he's going to belong to up until the point of his exile. So like the big key issues for the United Opposition that they were constantly harping on were, one, lack of free expression. So like the increase of inter-party democracy, right? They were still pissed with the NEP. They wanted to go back to war communism. And they were still pissed at socialism in one country, which Trotsky at this point was now calling a betrayal of Leninism itself, right?
Which is like so excessive. Like, what are you talking about?
Right. Yeah. He literally cannot let anything go. like throughout his entire life, right? It's just, it reminds me of the drill tweet, like the drill corncob tweet, you know?
Yeah.
Like that's him, man. He's just like, he just refuses to take the L. So like another big issue at the time also was Trotsky was absolutely livid with the way that Stalin and the Central Committee were handling the revolution in China, again, because didn't want to fuck with the peasants. And also was kind of like wary on aligning with the KMT, right?
Which is like such a complicated question, because like on the one hand, the Comintern did kind of fuck that one up really bad.
Yeah.
They were doing things that Trotsky at one point advocated. So, like,
yeah, I mean, and you know, the ultimate reasoning behind, like, you know, Stalin's push towards like the Communist Party of China aligning with the KMT at the time was because of the simple fact that the Communist China, like the Chinese Communist Party at that time, was really, really small. Like, they could not beat the Japanese. Or even like just the random warlords in the north, like on their own, like it just couldn't be done. And like, there's no way he could have known that, like, you know, Chiang Kai-shek was going to like really fucking betray them with like the Shanghai massacre a couple years down the line.
Nobody like, could have really known that was coming. Like, it was maybe inadvisable, but like, you know, it's, you can't exactly blame Stalin or Bukharin specifically. Yeah, like, it's complicated.
Yeah, and almost certainly, without the KMT, the Chinese Communist Party would have been wiped out. Yeah. So, you know, take what you will. So, this is kind of, like, going on, and, like, Trotsky's angle, I think, right now, is to, like, try to appeal to the youth, you know? Like, he's doing, like, a
hello, fellow youths.
Fellow greetings, fellow kids, sort of moment. And they're not feeling it. They all like Stalin.
What's really crazy is that, like, people don't realize that, like, the United Opposition, Trotsky doing all this shit, all of it was like legal, full, free expression. Like, they were publishing articles, they were publishing books. Like, this was like a vigorous debate in the public sphere.
Mm-hmm.
This was not like hidden or repressed or anything. That would come later, as we'll talk about, but like, this was like the marketplace of ideas, right?
Yeah, more or less. Like, it was not uncommon during this period to see like one position like publish an article in Pravda, and then within the next issue, like, you know, the response would be there.
Yeah.
Like, that, you know, that was just sort of like how they worked some of this shit out. Now, again, like, some of this stuff was decided upon, you know, and to like keep bringing it back up and up and up and up does sort of like, you know, delay things and wreck things, right? And towards the end of the United Opposition period, like by 1927, the Trotskyite bloc was actually organizing demonstrations basically against the party, like effectively violating party unity. Harry Haywood, who an American CPUSA member, communist guy, was over in Moscow in the 1927 and wrote about seeing this in his autobiography, Black Bolshevik. Like he writes about being in Moscow on the 10th anniversary of the revolution in 1927 and seeing Trotskyist counter demonstrators like throwing flyers and pamphlets from the windows of apartments and like hanging banners that basically said like remove Stalin or like oppose Stalin and shit like that. And like, knowing what we know about like him, like calling for slowdowns in the industrial sectors and stuff like that, as well as his, like, you know, his sort of tendency to just find an opening somewhere and just try to, like, you know, insert himself and wedge himself in there and use it to his advantage. Like, it was very clear that this guy was going to be a like continuous problem. Right.
Yeah.
So again, letting the democratic process take its course at the 15th Party Congress in 1927, the United Opposition was voted as incompatible with the Communist Party. And they were basically told to stop or get out. And, you know, Trotsky wouldn't stop. So first he was exiled to Kazakhstan in 1928. And then he was finally expelled from the USSR in general and fled to the island of Prinkipo in Turkey in 1929 with his second wife and his son, Lev Sedov. And there's a famous like anecdote I shared with you that I just got to mention because it's fucking hilarious. But Boris Bajanov, who was the personal secretary of Joseph Stalin, was there when Trotsky was expelled from the Soviet Central Committee and writes down this sort of story. Because the meeting ended with Trotsky being ordered to make a public statement admitting and apologizing for crimes against the worker state. Trotsky jumped from his seat and tried to slam the door of the throne room at the Kremlin. The hall door is massive. Trotsky pulled it with all of his strength, but the door was dead slow to open. In his fury, he did not notice and made repeated attempts to bang it shut. Thus, instead of witnessing a dramatic gesture indicating a historic breach, we watched a sorry figure struggling with a door. That's just, I mean, like, that's the guy, right? Like, that's that story, I think, is like really like telling of who this dude is. So yeah.
Oh, it's beautiful. No, I really liked what you wrote here about selling it, like, not.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. So, you know, his desperate pleas to sort of like rally all of these like opposition to his and the students and the young communists in the Soviet Union to his cause, and they just couldn't do it. And the United Opposition never caught on in popularity. And, you know, just to quote Junior Soprano, he couldn't fucking sell it.
Chill, and I'm like, bring that fucker bar. They say Blocker trippin', shouted on that other shit. What? I keep the crowd jumpin' like I'm Chris Cross, bitch. I ain't gon' cross over, ain't rap, nigga, move over. They say I ain't gon' make so bitch, yeah, I gotta show you. Man, I'm known in the hood for making that fucko bar. You know Blocker shoot first like John Stark. 40 nights, 40 days, no, it's art. If we was living in water, I'd be a shark. I'm in the front, you in the back, like Rosa Parks. Got heart like Rosa Parks, ayy, what a fuck to start. Don't got a gun, then I'ma use a dart. I fell in love with yellow diamonds since Gucci Mart. Bitch, we shooting over here, no martial art.
Okay, man, I'm finna go in, man. Real talk, man. I got nigga knowledge, your girlfriend pussy got hella mileage. I'm a street nigga, so middle finger to college.
They say snakes in the grass, so I'ma cut the shit. All these girls want this cash, so I can't trust a bitch. 12 pull up, run fast, ain't go to jail for shit. I got cars, ice and hoes, shout them nigga rich. They say snakes in the grass, so I'ma cut the shit. All these girls want this cash, so I can't trust a bitch. 12 pull up, run fast, ain't go to jail for shit. I got cars, ice and hoes, shout them nigga rich.
Cartier, no walk so high, think my ears pop right. Right here, where that lyric drop, pop out, yeah, like that's hot. Now where the bread, I'ma need that bill. Want it off the head, I'ma need like two. Nigga rich, what that make you? I'm the trigger chick, my belt, my proof. Now what you want? I'ma shut this down. Nigga try to front like I'm running this town. Nigga try to front like I'm worth this shit. Nigga hide the blunt, I smell the pig. While I'm tipping corners, I'm rolling with foreigners. My hoes be Brazilian, Sicilian, Honduras. Got bread to blow, got a mean 16. Turn the camera on, I'ma rep my team. I'm making hits like back to back. Y'all cute and shit, y'all try to rap. Get stupid shit, how you trying to act? I'm stupid rich, no platinum plaques. I'm nigga rich, boy, what you rap? No nigga business, no nigga check.
They say snakes in the grass, so I'ma cut this shit. All these girls want this cash, so I can't trust a bitch. 12 pull up, run fast, ain't go to jail for shit. I got cars, ice and hoes, shout them nigga rich. They say snakes in the grass, so I'ma cut this shit. All these girls want this cash, so I can't trust a bitch. 12 pull up, run fast, ain't go to jail for shit. I got cars, ice and hoes, shout them nigga rich.
Bro. related to Trotsky getting outmaneuvered and purged, the Soviets actually captured and executed the ace of spies, Sidney Reilly.
Oh, no shit.
The traditional narrative, if you were to read like Wikipedia or other histories of Reilly, the traditional narrative is that Reilly was tricked into coming back into the Soviet Union. Like, even though like he was burned, basically, like the Soviet Union knew that he wasn't working for them. And the narrative is that he was tricked into coming back by the trust. Now, without doing a whole episode length thing on the trust is one of my favorite topics right now. Basically, it was ostensibly a counter-revolutionary organization in the Soviet Union. It was supposed to be this like organization of white Russians and monarchists and counter-revolutionaries, but the trust was completely operated by the Cheka. It was a massive honeypot operation.
Wow.
So, I can never say his name. Dzerzhinsky, like, I think was like the main mastermind behind it.
Iron Felix, man.
Right? And he was basically doing shit that like the Okhrana would do to them, but like in reverse, right?
Yeah.
So like they knew how to do this, but it was this massive honeypot operation. It was a fake counter-revolutionary organization that it did several things. It identified counter-revolutionaries within Russia. Like, we're talking mostly during the Civil War and after the Civil War type time period. Mostly after the Russian Civil War. Uh-huh. And so they would identify counter-revolutionaries within Russia and monitor exile groups outside Russia. And like, for people who maybe don't realize, like, the white Russian community in every country was huge. There were tons and tons of white Russians who were just like, fuck this shit, I'm not doing the Soviet Union. And they all just went to like Germany, UK, America, even freaking China, you know, all over Japan. Like, literally every country had tons of white Russians. So like, different white Russian generals had different fiefdoms, right? So like, and sometimes they had massive amounts of gold bullion they stole, you know.
Yeah.
Almost like real little countries in exile, basically. So the trust was basically a huge trick, mainly to distract the white Russian generals outside the country and keep them from A, invading again, and B, carrying out acts of terrorism, which they did frequently. And like, so the trust was like a masterstroke, right? Mm-hmm. And the whole thing was literally a company. It was a front company called the Moscow Municipal Credit Association. And it pretended to be a normal financial institution. I'm not going to do a long thing on the trust, but like, basically they got an actual white Russian counter-revolutionary to flip and run it on behalf of the Cheka. And it bought the Soviet Union a good 5 crucial years in the 1920s where there were no major acts of terrorism from the white Russian generals. There weren't major terrorist attacks or invasions. And crucially, the game was to trick a bunch of white Russians into coming back into the Soviet Union, where if they were guilty of things, they were captured and or killed. And it was this huge, incredible feat of espionage. Like, there's this British historian named John Costello who said that the trust had the complexity of a symphonic score.
Wow.
It was just like so cool. But in a lot of ways, like I said, the Bolsheviks were just, or I guess the Soviet Union was doing what had been done to them. And they were using the same networks that like the Tsarists already had, but they flipped them. But even still, it was ingenious. Dzerzhinsky, of course, was the main guy. Iron Felix, he said.
Yeah.
And so the Cheka and then the OGPU, you know, eventually afterwards was running the trust. So the thing about Sidney Reilly being tricked into coming back into the country doesn't make sense, because Sidney Reilly already knew all about the trust. So like, he couldn't have been tricked into coming back just off of that, because he was like involved with the trust.
Yeah.
So there's this Sovietologist named Nathalie Grant, and she argues that the real story is that Sidney Reilly came back into the Soviet Union to meet with the trust's executive committee, where he was then arrested. And Stalin, we know for a fact that for some reason, Stalin was closely monitoring the situation with Sidney Reilly.
Yeah.
And he was so involved that he demanded updates every half hour as to the progress of Reilly getting arrested. Now, Professor Spence writes, why would Stalin have taken such a keen interest in the arrest of a single British spy? A dangerous Trotskyist agent, of course, would have been another matter. So Grant argues that the trust was secretly backing the Trotskyist opposition, which is to say that the trust was a real opposition group hiding within the honeypot organization.
Huh.
We're talking about a classic Wilderness of Mirrors situation, right?
Yeah, right. Like, not to be too crass, but like a Russian nesting doll.
Right?
Yeah. So let me ask a question.
Yeah,
Was that guy Yagoda in the trust?
I would believe that he might have been involved, because people in the NKVD were involved, but like, you know, the NKVD had to be a little bit hands off because it was like not supposed to be run by, you know, the Soviets. So like, he probably would have known Yezhov. Like, it's interesting to ask the question, who knew about the trust, who was like running it, involved, but like, I think that they assert that like Trotsky was involved with the trust. I think a lot of the top Bolshevik leaders knew that it like existed, because, you know,
yeah,
they were running everything.
I mean, so Yagoda, like, as you know, he was the head of the NKVD for a while, right? Like I would say like halfway through the Purge. And then in 1936, he was scooped up and they were like, we know that you're working with Trotsky.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's right. And like, the trust gets shut down abruptly. And by all accounts, it had been extremely successful. And so like, that book on Soviet intelligence that I was telling you about, it sort of like frames it like, oh, this was a stupid mistake. Mm-hmm. But it's like, well, it might not have been a mistake if they were just like, oh, fuck, our fake like honeypot is penetrated by a real opposition.
Yeah, that's crazy, man. There's a quote in the Lacerda book where he's describing like Stalin's like attitude. Like you said, like Stalin liked to be involved, right?
Mm-hmm.
He liked to be kept up to date about like military and intelligence matters, especially.
Yeah, he was very involved in intelligence. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And he was also quoted as saying, like basically, like, I don't give a shit about opinions, right? Like, I want to see, like, actual, like, provable facts, and I want to see enough of them where a conclusion can be, you know, sort of, like, accurately drawn, right?
Yeah, there's a lot to be made. Like, a lot of historians say, like, oh, Stalin didn't trust his spies. But it's like, would you?
Yeah, seriously, especially with the context of like, you know, things like the Promethean League, like existing, mm-hmm. As well as like, you know, the expeditionary forces from the capitalist countries that sent in, like there was, and the shit that Trotsky was getting into, like there was plenty of reason to be suspicious about a lot of different sort of like, you know, bodies within the Soviet Union at that time.
Yeah. So basically the argument is that Reilly was essentially executed because they were like, okay, we think we know what Trotsky's about to do. Let's cut the head off one of his main, like, allies, basically.
Damn.
So, and then I did have another anecdote here on the occasion of Trotsky being essentially exiled, right? So on October 3rd, 1928, while Trotsky was in Central Asia, you know, on his way out, he received a letter purporting to be from an American. This letter talked about books Trotsky had reserved at the New York Public Library. And this note came with a long string of numbers. The string of numbers does not pertain to books in the New York Library. Like, let's not pretend here. He got a coded message. Okay?
Yeah.
And supposedly this letter acknowledged Trotsky's proposed plan for an active struggle against Kinto. Kinto was Trotsky's disparaging name for Stalin. And the note also said, the material side of the project has been completely secured and the money sent has been deposited. And the note was signed, Yor Abram.
What?
His uncle Abram, man, sent him a coded message.
What?
Being like, we're starting the plan.
Damn. All right. Damn.
So from here on out, of course, we see a wave of outright terrorism coming from Trotsky's contingent. And you have a lot of good stuff on that. But like, when I read that story, I was like, oh, fuck yeah, Chad's gonna like that.
Yeah, damn, dude, that's a good one. That's like, he flicked that first domino down like as soon as he was asked to leave. Mm. If he got that letter in Kazakhstan, holy shit. Yeah, because I was really under the impression that the majority of his conspiratorial efforts like really began in Turkey. But yeah, man, if it began even before that, that's wild.
Yeah.
Shit. All right. Cool.
Stepper, 4L rapper. Hit him with a 20 piece ranch, lemon pepper. Black Air Force Ones dancing with the devil.
Young Metro, the whole chest, 20.
His wifey trouble, thought was finna cut her. I put out a rubber, Oz tried to slide on my brother. Had to up that cutter. When it smoke, we huddle. So many shots, down to shot each other. AR sister stutter. Draco Brown look like peanut butter. Don't play tic tac toe or tit for tat. Nigga, this ain't that. He was talking gangster on them tracks till I got him whacked. Gleazy with the switch and nigga splat. Ain't no ducking that. Y'all be smoking make believe, Ops. We be smoking facts. We be smoking gang after gang. Cock it back and bang. 21 for well, that's what I claim. Let your nuts hang. We don't shoot at houses, we hit brains. Y'all little niggas lame. Fell in love with them chopper sounds. Walk a flock of flame. Sliding, looking for the Ops. They been hiding. I grew up around drug assessing. Violence, we turned off that street. We heard sirens. Since a juvenile, I've been wildin'. Chrome hard jeans got me stylin'. Said he wanted smoke, now he joggin'. While you was in college, I was robbin'. Everybody running that car. 21. You ain't gon' make it that far. 21. Walk down with an AR. Straight up. We keep shit in the street. Oh God. They gon' put it in the bar. Oh God. Y'all niggas talking on pillow. All my Glocks got ditto. 21. Take your bank like CeeLo. 21. Draco bite mosquito. 21. Y'all niggas corny Frito. Pussy. Kel-Tec how to shoot Cheetos. Pussy. Y'all be talking that rah rah. Pussy. You ain't finna rah rah me though. Pussy. He went against me. He gon' step on him. I put my feet on. 21. I just made a op. Do the running man. Running man. Keep a elf in my color now. Color. Still ain't met a bitch that I cuff again. 21, 21. Still ain't met a bitch that I kiss. Oh God. He was talking crazy, he got blitzed. Great pop. Savage keep a talking John Wick. Shoot him in the back like he Rick. Playing freeze tag, nigga, it sticky. Sliding, looking for the Ops. They been hiding. I grew up around drug assessing. Violence, we turned off that street. We heard sirens. Since a juvenile, I've been wildin'. Chrome hard jeans got me stylin'. Said he wanted smoke, now he joggin'. While you was in college, I was robbin'.
Trust you, I'm gonna shoot you.
When your vision is crystal clear, they say it's razor sharp. A focused mind is said to be like a knife. But the scalpel is wisdom. All one can do is accept that life is a double-edged sword. Stay on the edge.